What I'm going to be talking about is future asymptotics of cosmological models, and I'm going to be focusing on the case where there are no symmetries. And of course that's a situation where pretty little is known, and there are, you know, some vague conjectures. And so I'll try to sketch out at least what is, what you can say, and raise a few questions, and at the end I'll present some recent work with Vince Moncrief having to do with expanding higher dimensional models without symmetries. And so there is a sort of basic dichotomy if you look at the future asymptotics of cosmological models. If you have accelerated expansion, then you have something like scry plus future horizons, and essentially the behavior, you know, in the far future is local in some sense. And so I don't have too much to say about that, but let me just since I'm going to be focusing on the case on vacuum, sort of normal matter, let me just say a few words about this. So the basic, so just see what's going on. The basic example is the sitter, minus dt squared plus cosh squared gamma. And here's the spherical metric. And that is conformal to a finite cylinder. So here is scry plus, and so you have future horizons in this sense. So an event here can influence only a small part of the total future of the space-time. And so you have a future horizon. In some sense, you have locality at scry plus. The global aspect of the space-time somehow doesn't matter. So topology does not matter. So these are, of course, very vague statements. But that seems to be the message. So whenever you have accelerated expansion coming from a cosmological constant, coming from a scalar field with potential, this seems to be the case. And also in these situations you have the possibility of getting asymptotic expansions at, let me just write scry plus for whatever future infinity you have. And so we've heard quite a bit about results in this direction from Alan Randall, from Mark Heinzle, and let me just mention a couple of names in this context. So Helmut Friedrich proved nonlinear stability of the sitter, and this was generalized to higher even space-time dimensions by Mike Anderson. We heard about this in Mark's talk. And it seems like the general space-time dimension case has still not been done. But it should be done reasonably soon, I guess. And Alan Randall has worked on asymptotic expansions and also Mark Heinzler. And many, of course, many others. I'm leaving out most of what is known. have worked on asymptotic expansions for Einstein equations or Einstein equations with matter near future infinity. And there's also some work by Ogla et al. On asymptotic isotropization. Which is done in quite a different, from a, quite a different point of view than what Alan and Mark used. So that's worth mentioning in this context as well. So one more point I wanted to make about this situation is that if you have, so let's say here is future infinity, if you have a piece of Cauchy data here, its domain of dependence will, of course, typically cover a piece of Scribe Plus. And so that means that if you want to do, in some sense, small data global existence results, those can be made to be local. And you can, at least, if you know the field equations, for example, if you have De Sitter, that implies a certain geometric conditions on data at Scribe Plus. For example, this conformal boundary in terms of the conformal background metric should be umbilical. So this means you can essentially characterize data here as being close to Scribe Plus, but not necessarily small in any usual sense, because the Einstein equations do not impose any restrictions on the geometry at Scribe Plus, if you look at the De Sitter space, for example, asymptotically, the De Sitter spaces. So this means that small data global existence can be made is local in some sense, simply because you have this. Simply because you have these future horizons. So the game is very different in this case. And I think there will, I guess, soon be results available in this setting. Okay, so that's about all I wanted to say about accelerated expansion. And so most of the talk is going to be devoted to normal matter. And since I don't know anything useful about perfect fluids, and very little is known in general as far as actual global existence results, so I'm going to simply restrict myself to vacuum for the rest of the talk. So. So vacuum, and I'm going to look at space-times, and the space-time is going to be m cross r, and let me assume that m is compact. And for most of the talk, it's going to be three-dimensional. But I'm going to present, as I said, the result that has to do with high-dimensional situations. So we have M, G, and K. These are Cauchy data. And let me define tau to be trace k. So that's the mean curvature. And the reduced Hamiltonian, we'll just define this as mean curvature cubed times volume of the current Cauchy surface. And for most of the time, I'm going to be talking about CMC time gauge. So that means that the time is, you impose the condition that mean curvature is constant on each Cauchy surface. This then becomes a time function, and you further impose a spatially harmonic gauge. So that means that you introduce a background metric, let's say gamma, and you require that the identity map from the current metric G to the same manifold with the background metric gamma is harmonic. That's a reasonable gauge and can be used in many different situations. And in this gauge, you have well postedness, and you have you can write down continuation criterion. So the Eisen equations in this gauge become well posed, and you can specify continuation criteria which allow you to prove global existence type results.
Say something about the compactness condition, because in the cases with symmetry, this almost makes the problem, astrophysically rather uninteresting and rather trivial, because it removes all the interesting modes. Is it absolutely essential for your analysis?
I don't have a good answer to that. I mean, I haven't looked very hard at this situation myself. And certainly some of the aspects, do survive, but there are no results. No results in a cosmological situation without symmetries. And I think even for the, with symmetries, for example, Gaudi, I don't know that there are any results there that deal with the non-compact case. And for other less, when you have less symmetry, that's also true. Okay. So this function, if you impose these conditions, then it turns out that this H reduced is monotone decreasing. Yeah. They say that, roughly speaking, as long as you have one derivative of the space-time metric under control in L infinity, as long as the space-time metric stays hyperbolic, stays non-degenerate, then you can continue the evolution. That's what it says. But I don't want to focus on that aspect. But roughly speaking, these continuation criteria can be used to prove global existence using energy methods. And this I think can be used in many these kind of continuation criteria. You have them whenever you have a good hyperbolic system. So together with energy methods, you can get quite a lot of mileage out of those in many different situations where you have small data, I think.
You're alluding, perhaps not stating a result here, Should one understand that the only assumption is that you have a CMC, especially harmonic edge, that there's no other assumption on the geometry of the initial data?
Well, I mean, this has been written down only in the case where the manifold admits a hyperbolic metric. There is a paper by myself and Moncrief on this, but I think that's a sort of technical restriction that's not really needed. So you can check that this in the expanding direction, this H reduced, this volume is monotone decreasing, and it decreases to the following value. And this sigma, so here, this is in the case of negative Yamabe class. So where the metric does not admit a positive scalar curvature metric. And somehow there is this idea that if you have a Cauchy surface that does admit a positive scalar curvature metric, you will have recollapse in the vacuum case. So there is the recollapse conjecture, and I think one of the authors is Greg. So more than one author here. Okay. So any questions can be directed to those guys.
I think there's been some advances since we wrote that.
So let me define this number here. Because it's going to come up somewhat later. So sigma is the supremum of the Yamabe invariant. And here you take the supremum over the space of conformal classes, and mu is the infimum over the volume and h to some certain power integral of scalar curvature. And here you take infimum over h in the conformal class of G. So this is a topological invariant. And in fact, you can express this sigma invariant in terms of, on the one hand, the infimum of the integrated scalar curvature to the power n halves, or as the infimum over the volume of metrics with constant negative curvature n times n minus 1, where n is the dimension of the Cauchy surface. So this is a well-known topological invariant. However, very, very little is known about it. And it's conjectured, for example, that in the case where M is hyperbolic, this can be computed in terms of the volume of the standard hyperbolic metric. And the jury is out whether or not that's actually a theorem. Okay, so let me just, for the purpose of discussion here, let me just introduce this. This is supposed to be either, for example, mean curvature squared times metric, or 1 over time to the proper time to the singularity times the metric. So this is supposed to be just the class of G, just for the sake of discussion. I'm not being very precise here. Let me point out that if I form quantities like this, or cosmological time square times curvature, those are roughly speaking scale invariant. So I'm going to state some observations on the behavior of these quantities in some examples, and state a couple of theorems where those quantities show up in the assumptions. So that's why I'm introducing those. So this is not meant to be perfectly precise here. Okay, so some examples where you can actually say what's going on. So first example is flat space times. So those are less trivial than you might think, because there is a finite dimensional moduli space of flat space-time geometries. And in this case, M, which if it's three-dimensional, is known to be either R3 geometry, SL2 R, or H3 geometry. And if in this case, if in the hyperbolic case, then it's known that the class of G actually goes to the standard hyperbolic metric on M. In the other cases, let me not say very much. So there is one case where you can actually nail this down. Okay. However, if you look at the Bianchi models, for example, things look more complicated. So if you look at Bianchi 1, you have the metric minus the t squared plus t to the 2p. Then it's only in the case with PQR equals 1, 0, 0, or permutations thereof. So that means that the spacetime is flat. Then you can say that the class of G goes to, roughly speaking, a circle. You have one direction which is expanding, the others are not expanding. So if you take out the scale, the spatial slice goes to a circle. In Bianchi 3, you have a trivial circle bundle over a Riemann surface, so the class of G goes to a Riemann surface. In Bianchi 8.
What do you mean goes to? This is like you're evolving with Einstein equations?
Yeah, so you evolve the Einstein equation, you take out the scale, and the fiber collapses, and what's left over is the two-dimensional Riemann surface.
Expanding or collapsing?
Always in the expanding direction, future asymptotics.
There's two notations, perhaps. Is this a statement that the conformal class of the metric is asymptotic to the conformal class that you're describing?
Well, what I mean is, form this combination, one of those combinations, whichever suits you best, and simply look at the limit in terms of Gromov convergence. I think that's the best way to state it.
The Gromov-Hausdorff limit of the geometry is actually.
So the three geometry actually collapses down, which is. Okay. And because here, the space time, the spatial slice is a circle bundle over a Riemann surface. Here, for Bianchi 8, it's also a space circle bundle over a Riemann surface, but in this case, the bundle is trivial. Is non-trivial, sorry. in that case as well, you have that the geometry collapses, but in this case you have something like this, that so if you form, if you take, instead of t squared, you take t log t times curvature. This is, this does not go to zero. This was proved by Hans. And this will become interesting later on. So this is the case if you have a non-nut Bianchi 8. For a nut Bianchi 8, which means you impose some extra conditions, you have faster curvature decay. Okay.
You say that nut is at the top.
Yeah, Taub or nut, I don't know. What's the... Okay, so if we look at... So let me leave the other Bianchi classes out of this. Now if we look at Gaudi, which we've heard a lot about, then also in that case, the metric tends to go to a circle. And note that this is, so if my understanding is that this happens as soon as you go to an inhomogeneous Gaudi. But if you have a homogeneous Gaudi, you can have, a Kästner which is non-flat, and then it's unclear what happens. I don't know if this kind of limit makes sense in that case. Here also you have this kind of curvature behavior. So this is the good kind of curvature behavior in some sense. G2 question mark. One could guess that it behaves as Gaudi, but no one really knows. Okay, and finally, among these examples, there's U1. So Gaudi, as you recall, has, and G2, they have a two-dimensional abelian symmetry group, so a torus action. U1 has a circle action, in the case, so there is work by Shokibriha and Moncrief, and by Shokibriha. So this is in the case where, so the Cauchy surface here in general would be a circle bundle over a surface. And what they handle here is genus of the surface bigger than one and a trivial bundle. So these results are sort of nonlinear stability of Bianchi 3 with U1 symmetry. So since they're assuming a trivial bundle, they're considering perturbations of Bianchi 3, but imposing this U1 symmetry. And what they find is that the space-time geometry nicely settles down to this kind of Bianchi 3 behavior. There is no dynamics left over, at least in the Teichmuller variables. So what happens is that if you look at Teichmuller space, so if you take the class of the Teichmuller class of the reduced metric, it in general, will evolve, but it will settle down to a final point. Okay. So question marks here are non-trivial. And genus equal one. Those are probably quite difficult problems. And here it was remarked by Yvon Chokherbihan that the reason the methods, the energy methods that are used here don't work is that, or don't work directly, is that the energy which involves curvature has a topological quantity that is non-zero if the bundle is non-trivial. And you can speculate, one might speculate that this exceptional behavior of the curvature in Bianchi 8 has to do with the fact that you have the non-trivial topology in that case. Okay, and then finally there's the G naught case, and here there's a result if M is of hyperbolic type. So you see M is of hyperbolic type, and then what you find is that the class or the metric actually converges to the unique hyperbolic metric on that free surface. So there's no funny business there, and you also find that the curvature has this good behavior. That's a result by myself and Moncrief. Okay, so this somehow shows a little bit what is known in this case, and it points out that the behavior of the curvature is somehow seems to be quite crucial. And now I'd like to mention just briefly a couple of results. There is, first of all, a result by Mike Anderson, and which has later been generalized by his student Martin Riris. And what this result talks about is asymptotic geometrization in the expanding direction. So here, in all of these cases, you might very vaguely say that there is some kind of asymptotic geometrization going on. And here, in particular, the class of the metric does converge to the sort of Thurston geometrized version of the manifold, of the metric. So you might ask if this is a more general feature. Yeah.
Question for one. So in your result, how do you exploit the fact that you're assuming that M is, since you're not assuming anything about the initial data, the geometry, except that it admits a metric hyperbolic? How do you use that?
Well, very good question. So the reason this is simple in some sense, and if I have time, I'll show you, it's sort of, the reason this works is essentially, first year calculus. And it's really has to do with the fact that if you have a hyperbolic metric, then minus the t squared plus t squared gamma is flat. So this is a flat Lorentz cone. And furthermore, there is a homotheta. So I think it's t d by the t is a homotheta. So there's a homotheta, time-like homotheta, which means that using this fact and using the fact that the Weyl tensor in vacuum, which is just the Riemann tensor, satisfies the Bianchi identities, you can use, you can write down an energy which is essentially the square of the Weyl tensor. And that energy then has nice decay in the expanding direction. And the reason is that you have this homotheta. So this is something that in some sense makes this case a lot simpler than the U1 case.
Those observations are for the asymptotic metric, not for the geometry that you start
yes,
with.
Yes, but
how do you connect that to the geometry you start with?
Well, so what you prove is that if you give data that's close to I'm talking about the nonlinear stability result.
Okay, so this.
So
is,
if you give data that's close to this, to data induced from this geometry, you will converge to essentially to this geometry.
So it's a small data
result. Yeah, and also the so. This is nonlinear stability. Here we also have nonlinear stability. Okay. So I'd like to tell you about this result by Mike Anderson. And to give background to that, this result essentially says the following, that if you have rather strong conditions on the space-time curvature, it's unclear how realistic these are, probably not very realistic. Then the Cauchy surface, if you take the class of the metric on the Cauchy surface, that undergoes geometrization in a certain sense. And so I should say what geometrization means. Well, the general idea is if you have a three-manifold, it can be decomposed in a unique way under connected sum into a collection of prime pieces. Connected sum is where you delete a ball on two three-manifolds and connect them by a tube. Okay, so you can make a unique decomposition in this way. Further, if you have a prime or irreducible manifold, three-manifold, then there is a finite collection of disjoint incompressible tori that decomposes this manifold further. And the pieces will be torus irreducible or ciphered fibered. And so ciphered fibered means essentially that the space is a kind of circle bundle over some surface. So such manifolds can be collapsed in the fiber direction without causing curvature to blow up. And this is very important in the result of Mike Anderson. And so the geometrization conjecture says that if you each component of this sphere and torus decomposition admits a geometric structure. And the geometric structures, there is a list of 8 geometric structures, nil, sol, etc. There's essentially correspondence between those and the Bianchi classes. Okay. So, and Thurston geometries are sort of, have the minimal amount of freedom. The Bianchi have the maximal amount of freedom within each class. And a slightly weaker condition is weak geometrization. So weak geometrization, roughly speaking, has the same content as geometrization, but without the uniqueness. So this essentially is just a decomposition. M is H union G, and so this is. So let me write this. So this is a collection of hyperbolic pieces. This is a collection of graph manifolds. So roughly speaking, fibered manifolds which can be collapsed without curvature blowing up, and they're joined along a collection of tori. So they can be sort of collapsed in the fiber direction without having curvature blow up. Okay. So what Mike proved is the following. So you assume, roughly speaking, that this is bounded, and plus conditions on higher order curvature. So actually there's a condition on the first derivative of curvature as well. So you assume something like this. So remember, this condition is violated by Bianchi 8, but it's satisfied by Gaudi, for example. Then if you have this on the whole space-time, to the future on some m naught. So on the whole future of some Cauchy surface, then in fact, then you have geodesic completeness, and there is a sequence of times such that converges to a weak geometrization. So there is a sequence of times so that the geometry, if you take out the scale on this instance of time, times converges to weak geometrization. So the picture is something along the following lines. So roughly speaking, you have this initial hypersurface, and you have if you look if you take out the scale, what you'll be left with is a collection of hyperbolic pieces which form cusps, and here you have, and they're connected by collapsed graph manifolds, and so this is the picture of the Cauchy surface at very late times in this theorem. Of course, those conditions are terribly hard to check. And there is a recent result which is not yet published by Martin Rieris, who is a student of Mike Anderson's, which replaces this kind of global condition with a more complicated condition, essentially on the initial data. So essentially a small energy condition related to the small energy condition that was used in the proof of this theorem with Moncrief. Okay, so this is, roughly speaking, a very, very quick overview of what's known actually at this level of generality. And so I wanted to finish off. Yeah.
So this convergence again is just Bromov-Hausdorff convergence.
Yeah.
So I shouldn't think of the my Cauchy surface as kind of there are areas where it's pointwise converging to hyperbolic manifold, pointwise where it's looking like a graph manifold and going to collapse.
Well, you don't have. I mean, you have some kind of C alpha, C one alpha control or something like that. L2P, so it's not, in that sense, you have on the non-collapsing pieces, you have a certain amount of control. But of course, that's all very indirect, because the central machine in this proof is a result that says that if you have a manifold with bounded curvature, which you will have, so the Cauchy surfaces will essentially have bounded curvature. Then, if you look at the sequence of such manifolds with bounded diameter and volume, then you can have three situations. And these can happen at three different regions on the manifold. You can have convergence. You can have collapse, which corresponds to the graph pieces. Or you can have cusps, which corresponds to these hyperbolic pieces. So here you have thick regions and thin regions. So there's a general fact that is the reason behind this result in some sense. And in this result by Riris, the basic machine is a similar result, except that in that case the curvature bounds in the sort of geometric part are L2 curvature bounds. But he adds then a condition on this rescaled Hamiltonian. So he has curvature in L2, rescaled Hamiltonian under control, and then he gets, what he proves is essentially a trichotomy type result like that. And so then once you have a global evolution, then you can use this to determine the limit of the metric. Okay. So and so I should say that here we see somehow that topology plays an important role in the asymptotic behavior. And in all of these cases, it seems to be that you have as much expansion as the symmetry group allows, or as much as the topology allows. And if you have a hyperbolic piece, then you will have the maximum amount of expansion. Yeah?
How does Bianchi 1 fit into the scheme where everything has collapsed?
Well, so those are the Cauchy surfaces are tori, so they are graph manifolds. So they can collapse without causing any curvature blow up. And that's what they do. So if you look more carefully at the Bianchi examples or Gaudi, you actually collapse to a circle.
This is compatible with this picture. I thought you were.
Yeah, but here you're looking for here. I'm drawing sort of the three-dimensional scale. So these guys are actually surviving as three manifolds. Those guys are actually collapsing to something lower dimensional. So, but all of the volume is contributed by these hyperbolic pieces, and those guys have the maximum amount of expansion that's allowed in a vacuum, which is T squared, which corresponds to this hyperbolic cone. Okay. So I'm just going to say, I should finish reasonably soon. But so I'm going to say a few words about a recent, as yet unpublished result with Vince Moncrief that covers this situation and quite a bit more, and somehow the proof is reasonably simple, so I can almost explain it in 10 minutes.
Sorry, you said it covers. You mean the high dimensional generalization?
Then? Yes. And okay, so. So if I consider, so let M be the Cauchy surface, and let gamma be some Einstein metric, negative Einstein metric on that. So we have Ricci of gamma is minus n minus 1 over n squared times gamma. So this is the normalization that we use. If you have this, then this metric is Ricci flat. So whenever you have a negative Einstein, you form the cone, it's going to be Ricci flat. This holds in any dimension. And this is just a coincidence that you have the hyperbolic metric in three dimensions. So those are going to be the background spaces.
These are not generally flat.
Sorry? Exactly. So those are, but they're Ricci flat. So what we're going to prove is a nonlinear stability result for data close to such cone space times. So now, in higher dimensions, in three dimensions, the only negative Ricci metric is the hyperbolic metric. In higher dimensions, you can have a deformation space. So gamma, you can have a non-trivial deformation space of negative Einstein metrics. So examples are provided by Keller-Einstein metrics, or you can just take a suitably scaled product of a hyperbolic with a Riemann surface. So there you can deform the Riemann surface metric, leave the hyperbolic fixed, and that gives you a family of negative Einstein metrics. So there's there's a non-trivial deformation space. And so this one can deal with as well. And so we're going to work in CMC spatially hyperbolic gauge, which works in this generality without any trouble. So I'm just going to basically give you the punchline of the proof. And so if my physical data are G twiddle, K twiddle, X twiddle, so I'm switching notation, N twiddle. So those are going to be the physical data, and tau is trace K. Then I define new variables by simply taking out the scale. So this is analogous to what Wojciech did, for example. So sigma is the trace-free metric, X is the rescaled shift vector field, and N is the rescaled lapse. Okay. And if you're at the background, if you're at one of these cone metrics, you have G sigma. And X is just gamma 0 n 0. So we're going to look at data near such a background data and then linearize, identify an energy, and then use the energy to prove global existence. So this energy will have a certain amount of decay. And so let me just point out that if you write down, so now the Eisner equations is going to be written in terms of these scale invariant variables. So you have evolution equations, constraint equations, and equations which fix the shift and lapse. And I'm not going to write down any equations, but let me point out that, so if you also impose, we change the time here. So this is a scale invariant time. So this is very analogous to Ugla et al. Type variables. So now you write down those equations, and what you find is that the equation for sigma contains somewhere along the way this thing here. Okay, and the linearization of this expression is then going to be very important. So we simply define an operator L naught, which is going to act on trace-free, divergence-free two tensors, which is going to be the derivative, the Fréchet derivative of this thing here in the direction hij. So roughly speaking, like that. So this is a kind of Lichnerowitz Laplacian. And this can be expanded out in terms of background covariant derivatives and background Weyl tensors. So if you follow this procedure, you have now, after a bit of work, written down the evolution equations. Then you linearize and do a separation of variables using the spectral decomposition of this operator here, which is, in all examples of negative Einstein spaces, has a non-negative spectrum. Okay? And what you find is the following simple system. And this is the crucial point, and I'm going to stop once I explain this. Okay, so you simply take the evolution equations, you do a separation of variables, you linearize, you do a separation of variables, and you find the following equation for x dot dot plus n minus 1 x dot plus n squared lambda x equals 0. So here x is an eigentensor of that operator. Lambda is an eigenvalue. And this is a damped harmonic oscillator, which you recognize from first year calculus, more or less. And the characteristic roots of this guy are minus n minus 1 plus minus square root of n minus 1 squared minus 4n squared lambda over 2. And so depending on whether or not lambda is greater than n minus 1 squared over 4n squared or not, you get different behavior. If lambda is greater than that value, then the real part is always n minus 1 over 2. If it's smaller than that value, you can have other decay behavior. And in fact, as lambda goes down to 0, the slowest rate of decay is going to 0. Okay? So now you can easily write down an energy which has the property that energy, time derivative energy is greater than some particular number, which is essentially that. So for such a damped oscillator, you can write down an energy which has decay properties. And alpha plus is minus n minus 1 over 2 if lambda is greater than n minus 1 squared over 4n squared. And you can figure it out yourself if you have the other situation. Okay? So this immediately, from this you immediately see that there is a decaying energy. So this leads you to introducing energies, and this energy is of the following form. So let me show. This is so it has a it's a modified energy. Okay, so there is some explicit constant you can introduce. So if you just take the oscillator energy, it doesn't work. You compute the time derivative and you're missing something. You have to add this kind of cross term to make it work. And this is a well-known trick. Okay, so you have this energy, which is built in terms of eigenvalues of this Lichnerowitz-Laplacian. So what in fact does work is that you simply then write down a wave equation type energy involving a modified Lichnerowitz-Laplacian. And this has then modulo lower order terms the same rate of decay. Okay. So as long as the bottom of the spectrum of this Lichnerowitz-Laplacian is positive, you're fine. And that corresponds to the case when this deformation space is a point. Otherwise, you can also deal with that. Okay. So I think my time is up. But I just wanted to point out that the results that I had with Vince actually has this kind of very, very simple root. We did not see this when we did the work originally. Another thing that you note from this is that the characteristic roots here really have the property that most of the eigenvalues have the same real part. And in the complex plane, the characteristic roots, go off like that. And what that means is that there is no, at least, so this distinguishes this situation from the case where you have accelerated expansion and where you are able to get asymptotic expansions. Because here you have waves with different frequencies piling up with the same overall rate of decay. And there is no obvious way to separate them out. Okay, so I think my time is definitely up.
I just wanted to make a remark that looking over all the things you were doing, there seems to be a pre-Perelman, a Ricci flow counterpart to just about all of them. What was particularly striking is our some recent stability results that we had.
Yes,
what you were doing there. And also
in the Ricci flat case, yeah.
Yeah, and also the stuff, those conditions that Mike had sound like the type 1 kinds of collapse.
Yeah, certainly. I mean, the same kind of result that Mike is using is also used in the Ricci flow business.
All these analogies, similar sorts of results.
That comes from the Chigurh-Gromov.
Sorry?
That's from the Chigurh-Gromov.
Yes.
Not from Hanoi.
The basic convergence
results.
Yeah,
he talks about the type 1 the singularities which have that control behavior.
Exactly.
And then it shows that for all of which it flows, which you have this kind of behavior, you have the Chigurh-Gromov behavior.
Yeah, exactly. But the sort of result comes from Chigurh-Gromov.
It's
so
the geometry behind it.
So are there cases when somehow, I mean, I thought there was some center manifold business going on here.
There is. So I didn't have time to explain this, but if this V is non-trivial, so that means that the bottom of the spectrum of this operator is zero, then what will typically happen is that, so you have this center manifold, and some of the evolution comes in, and if you start close enough, it's going to be sucked into that and eventually end up at some point on the center manifold.
And that corresponds to eigenvalue, one eigenvalue being zero.
Yeah.
You said that you can still deal
You can still deal with this, yeah. So I'm thinking that this could be useful in other situations where you have a deformable geometry. And this is, yeah, sorry.
You said that in all known examples, the spectrum is non-negative, but what is the class of examples?
Well, I guess the only examples that I know personally are the Kähler-Einstein and these products of stable guys with, let's say, Riemann surfaces. And in those cases, you can check that this condition is true. And we've talked to quite a number of people, and no one has been able to come up with a counterexample. For the spectrum being non-negative. So if you indeed had a negative Einstein manifold with negative spectrum, then it would be unstable from the point of view of this the Einstein flow. So that would be very interesting if one could come up with such an example.
But we've been calculating this sort of thing for the solved geometry. It looks like that might be the case.
But those are not negative Einstein.
I thought you meant general. You mean for...
I think for others, if you look at positive Einstein, I think you can have this, for example, and probably for Ricci flat. But for negative Einstein, there is no counterexample to this, known to me at least.